Golf Today.
Golf Today, it's Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine, an NCAA title to be decided today out in California. We've got a major champ visiting us and the coach of a major championship as well.
Yeah, Chris Como, who still refuses to give me a lesson. Padraig Harrington, who has given me a lesson. They're about the same vintage as us. Thankfully, we've got a teenager who's coming in to kind of skew the index down a little bit.
No question about it. A lot of fun in this two-hour edition of Golf Today. And speaking of a lot of fun, what a week it was last week for Xander Schauffele, the aforementioned winner of the 106th PGA Championship, and taking some heat on social media about his close calls, was questioned about it and probed about it, found a way to win that first major in his 28th major start, began the week as the only player in the top five in the official world golf ranking without a major, now the two in the world. There he is with Chris Como. They've been working together now for about half a year. Como worked with many top players in the profession tour. That'll be Tiger Woods from 2014 to 2017. And after Xander's win on Sunday, he gave credit to Chris Como's impact.
Xander, your golf swing is a little bit different maybe than it was a year or two ago. How did those changes on this golf course this week help you sit next to the trophy?
Yeah, all year actually. It's been, this is probably the most comfortable I felt with some of the changes that, Chris was able to implement. They weren't big changes, just getting the club a little bit more on plane up top was key. Shoulders maybe a little bit steeper. I trend to go a little bit flat and a little laid off. So I felt like last week there's some intimidating tee shots there. I was able to hit some good drives. So I pulled on that a little bit this week, knowing that the fairways are soft. So if you hit a good drive, it's going to pretty much end up where it goes. And it's been amazing working with Chris. He's been awesome and definitely a contributing factor to me holding this thing today.
And so great to have Chris Como with us on this Wednesday. You heard Xander Schauffele talking about the final pieces of the puzzle. In your mind, what was the final piece of the puzzle that has made him a major championship winner?
Oh, man. Time. Just time, honestly. I think it was going to happen just by the way he's been playing for quite a while now. That's very, generous of him to say that. And, I do feel like the work we've done has been positive. But I mean, he's been a great player for a long time, and this was an inevitable thing. Especially the way he's been playing, really this last X amount of whatever the stretch is, it's been great. So yeah, I just think time was he just needed to kind of keep doing what he was doing, and it was going to happen.
When you start working with someone, Chris, who is playing at that level for a sustained period of time, is it something as a general swing philosophy you start working on, or is it sort of data-based on certain areas where he might think he's underperforming?
I mean, it's definitely a big due diligence on my part where, we looked at swings throughout his whole lifetime. I chatted with his dad. There was a lot of just me taking in information about how he processes the game, how he sees his own swing, what are some stretches where he's felt the most comfortable with his swing, looking at stats where there might be some small edges to be found. And then, through that, it's like, what is the least invasive thing you can do to try to get a little extra edge of stuff? Because when someone's already very, very good, you want to get better, but there's also a lot of room to get worse, potentially. So you got to be, pretty careful and thoughtful with how you're going about it.
Chris, these players are all so different. They're individuals. What kind of learner is Xander Schauffele? Audible, visual, feel, mechanical. How would you describe him?
That's interesting. That's an interesting question. I would say a little bit of both. Most people are a little bit of both and are a little bit of all those things. I don't want to say reckless, but he is borderline, just give it to me. And I was like, okay, we got to time this in a way that's not overwhelming, that's not too disruptive to your playing and how you're already playing. So he's the type of learner who is just super eager and was like, give me what I need to do, potentially to a fault. And I think this is where, we both knew that it would be appropriate to sometimes tap the brakes and just give things in more of a slow drip fashion, even though he was eager to do as much as possible, as quickly as possible.
You mentioned the work Xander had done with his father over the years. Chris, what's the dynamic like when you start working with a player whose only coach has been a family member? Does that add a layer of complication in any respect?
It could be in a lot of instances, but in this instance, it wasn't. I talked, a fair amount with Stefan. He's like, what he's done with his, there's things that they've done where Xander's told me about. I'm like, that is like brilliant, like really smart the way they've gone about stuff to really preserve a certain athleticism and feel in his game. And I think Stefan was just ready to kind of, pass the reins on. So it's been a really great process. I mean, there's been instances where, working with a parent can have its own sort of curveballs to it. But this time it's been really great. He's been awesome. And the overall team Xander has around him, I mean, his caddy, Austin Kaiser, is brilliant out there with course manager, and just keeping Xander like in the right place, emotionally, mentally. He's got a trainer, Marnus, who is, works with a bunch of guys on tour. He actually, Marnus also works with Scottie Scheffler. I joked with him the other day. I'm like, we're on the Marnus Grand Slam watch now, because he's got two of the first two majors with his clients, and then a trainer, David Sundsberg, which is a big part of where Xander's gotten a lot of his speed from. And then his putting coach, Derek Ueda, which, Xander, that's what won him this tournament, was his putting on Sunday. So he's got an awesome team around him.
Chris, you put all this work in before the major championship, at the major championship. Then you arrive to a final round on Sunday. What is that like for you, that walk, watching your player trying to break through for the first time?
Oh, wow. It's because there is the element of like, hey, just keep doing what you've been doing. I think everybody knew it was a matter of time, but then you can't get away from like the moment of it. And, there is this chance you have right now. And there's just a lot of, I couldn't believe how nervous I was on that putt on Sunday. He was so calm. Like I was there with his wife and one of his best friends that's also a good friend of mine. And I was like, I was nervous, and I almost never get nervous at golf tournaments. And then when he made that putt, we were all pretty emotional just because of the work he has put into it and just the quality of a person he is. And just, you can just tell he just loves this game and loves competing. It just, it was kind of a, just like, I think a release for everybody. It was a really special moment.
Chris, you're known as a guy who lives a very healthy lifestyle. Did you at least manage to take some celebratory champagne from the Wanamaker Trophy?
Yeah, I rarely drink, but, champagne tastes that much better out of that trophy. So yes, I did get to experience it. And I nursed about a 2-day hangover. So it was a moment that was very worth paying for it the following days.
Chris, I'm curious how you describe yourself as a teacher these days. Where does the line from teacher to coach land with you in terms of technique versus maybe just an old school motivational speech?
I don't think you can separate the golf swing from the emotional, from the mental, from the stats, from all the parts of it. Like you just can't separate these things. So I do think, especially as I've gotten more like further along in my career, you do look at things more holistically. I don't know if the motivation side of it is like necessarily a rah-rah type of thing, because that's not always appropriate either. But with Xander, I think it was parroting a philosophy that him and his dad have, which, they always talk about the constant dripping wears the stone. And after Quail Hollow, it's like, you start to get a bit of a narrative out there where people are like, oh, can he finish a tournament? Yada, yada, yada. And the reality of it is like, I mean, there was nothing he can do. He ran into a buzzsaw with Rory, and the way he's been playing all year, it's like, just keep doing that. And I do think how he went into Valhalla, the attitude he went to in it with, is a testimony to his resiliency, because he knew he was doing all the right stuff. He was doing what he can do, and he's just got to keep doing that. And then it does become a matter of time. It happened this week. And I think, his ability to block out that external noise of those potential chatters and narratives that are out there is just a testimony to who he is as a person and, his ability to work more from that outward perspective than that outward-inward perspective. So I had a lot of admiration for him, and I just, again, parroted kind of a philosophy that they've built within their own team. And, I don't think it's a rah-rah motivational type of thing, but it is just, using logic to be like, hey, just double down on what you've been doing.
On a more practical angle, Chris, Jordan Spieth said Xander was getting sneaky fast, and he's added 3 miles an hour of clubhead speed. He was 28th on tour last year. He's 8th on tour this year. For the uneducated among us, how do you go about doing that with an elite player? Because that is a reasonably significant jump in speed.
Yeah, I think it's oftentimes a combination of a couple different things that come together to, you know, a little half a mile here, half a mile there. He's done some great work in the gym, like I managed with David Sundsberg, and he also has worked great with Marnus, which is keeping his body healthy. Some of the changes we've made with his golf swing have been helpful. So I just think it's a little bit here, a little bit there. You try not to do this too fast. I think there's a difference between what I would call dirty speed and clean speed. You know, I think sometimes guys try to get speed without really watching how it may be changing their golf swing, especially their swing's already really good. And then you can get yourself into a bit of a bind doing it that way. But there's been a handful of times where I've helped, you know, a guy get some speed, and it's always like a close monitoring of how they're doing it, what's going on with their golf swing to achieve that, and making sure that there are certain parameters that, yes, you can get speed, but you're not going to do it this way that might, you know, affect your release pattern or your face control or whatever it is. So, I think a lot of it is just you can't build Rome in a day and being okay with a pacing that's not trying to do it overnight, but saying, hey, look, you know, within the course of a year, I can add X amount of miles per hour to my clubhead speed. Chris, and do it in a way that's, yeah.
Well, there have been some wonderful players throughout the history of this game who have won one major championship, tremendous players, whether it's Freddie Couples, Davis Love III, Adam Scott has one, Justin Rose, for example. How does Xander keep the pot boiling and this becomes the beginning of a major championship legacy as opposed to the pinnacle of his career, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, you can't predict these things, right? I mean, I just think he goes about it the right way where he's so into the process, which is another way of just saying you're so into the journey of it. And I don't think he gets too caught up in the results on any given day. It's more of how do you look at your career as one big round of golf, and then during that you have these little intervals that are tournaments, and you know, if you time it right, you get a trophy from it. So I really think he just naturally loves the game, is very competitive, loves working hard at it, and again, I think he just gets so much joy out of the process of it that I think that's the recipe for really rattling off quite a few. And if you look at his game, I mean, he's ranked two in the world now, behind Scotty. And, you know, here's like a little stat, but his strokes gained right now, 91% of the time would be number one ranked player in the world. But now you have a guy who's a bit of an outlier with Scotty, right? So he's playing at a level that should really give him a chance to win quite a few of these big ones. And then it's just a matter of, does it kind of, fall the right way at the right time type of thing. But, you know, all the ingredients are in there to really rattle off quite a few of these.
This is a guy, Chris, that everyone expected was going to win a major championship. Now you've helped him get over the line and do that. With all due respect, doesn't seem like that big a challenge for you. Are you ready for a tougher challenge one of these days?
I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm trying to keep my career somewhat low stress right now. So it's like, I feel like I've taken on the big challenges already. So I'm kind of like in that semi-retirement phase. So I think I'm going to have to pass.
As the kids say, you don't want this smoke.
No, he really doesn't. I'll break him down eventually.
Chris, congratulations.
The problem is, if Xander was so complimentary when he won the Wanamaker, right? But if Amen won whatever his goal was, club championship or whatever, I know in that receptive speech, it would look something like, in spite of the attempted help from Chris Como, I was still able to win this trophy.
There'd be a hug and then there'd be a dagger.
He's not wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
He ain't wrong.
Chris, we appreciate it, buddy. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys.
And Gil Hance joins us now from Colonial. It's great to see you. What's it like to have that kind of stamp of approval from a Texas native and gentleman in Jordan Spieth who knows Colonial so well?
Great to be with you guys. It's wonderful. I mean, yeah, obviously you always want to hear good things about the work that you do. To have that, you know, stamp of approval from somebody who's played here, grown up in this area, understands the history and the tradition of Colonial, and obviously understands the golf course really well, I think it's an amazing compliment, and Jim and I are pretty excited about that.
Gil, this golf course is associated more with Ben Hogan than anyone else, and I believe Hogan said that a straight ball gets you in more trouble at Colonial than it does anywhere else. Was that actually true, and is it still true?
I think so. I mean, you look at the way these holes twist and turn. I think angles are relevant here. So straight ball really sometimes will put you at a disadvantage when it comes to the angles into the greens. You know, I had the amazing good fortune to speak with Dan Jenkins prior to his passing, and he talked about how Colonial was like playing in a hallway. There were always these trees, and you're hitting into these sort of dark corners where the greens set up. And so it always placed a premium on ball striking, hitting the ball, moving it, shaping it, getting yourself in position to take advantage of it. And if you got yourself out of position, you really struggled to get back into it. So there's no reason, you know, you certainly understand why Ben Hogan loved this place for being a ball striker.
Gil, that said, what are the challenges of doing a renovation on a golf course with a smaller footprint than some of the other renovations you've done?
Well, I think the biggest challenge here was the timeline. I mean, it was really, you know, after the last putt dropped last year, it was difficult. You know, we had a very tight window to build in. And I think to a certain degree, the smaller footprint actually helped us out. You know, when you start from a construction standpoint, you're working from irrigation and working your way out so you can carry water with you. And so we knew exactly where that water was coming from over by the maintenance facility. So we knew our route was going to be coming down 12, doing 13, working our way out of that corner through the rest of the golf course, and then ultimately ending up at the driving range, which worked out well, because if you're going to want to build something last, the driving range is a good place to finish a project. So within those corridors, we were able to work very tight. You know, basically, the demolition occurred, then the shaping, then the reconstruction, the drainage, then irrigation came in, and everybody moved in lockstep through the property. It was actually an amazing effort. And because we had these tree-lined corridors, because we had to protect a lot of the outer play areas, we were able to limit somewhat the scope of the disruption.
Gil, I've read that your inspiration for this renovation was the 1941 U.S. Open that was played at Colonial. Why that particular moment in time in the long history of this golf course?
Well, I kind of feel like it was the high water mark. When the golf course first was constructed, holes 3, 4, and 5, the horrible horseshoe, were not part of the original design. So Sir Leonard went out and found this property, added to it, then brought Perry Maxwell in to build those three holes, design them, and then also to freshen up the rest of the golf course. So when you have an architect like Maxwell putting his stamp on Colonial, I think that's really a good place to start. And the other part of it is we had the documentation. You know, sometimes when you have the opportunity to look at photographs, especially from on the ground during, you know, the run-up to the championship, you had great aerial photography. All of that allowed us to at least focus in on stylistically what we were trying to accomplish, and we also felt it was the high watermark architecturally. After that point in time, the golf course underwent a series of significant changes, primarily engineering related. You know, they straightened out the Trinity River that used to flood the entire golf course. So all of these changes were not driven by architecture, they were driven more by engineering. So we wanted to go back to a period of time that we had the information at our disposal. We had arguably the best architect who has ever worked on this property, maybe arguably the best architect who ever worked, period. And then we had the opportunity to go ahead and trace that back, you know, from an architectural quality standpoint.
Gil, there's a line from the movie Shawshank Redemption, the world's gone and got itself into a big hurry. Why does a golf course like Colonial matter to the PGA Tour and the world of golf?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a big traditionalist. I love working and protecting and restoring these great old golf courses along with, you know, with Jim. So I think from our standpoint, having very few of them left on the tour, right? It's basically Riviera, Colonial, Harbortown, I guess, would fall into that category, although it's obviously not as old as those two golf courses. I think that's important from a heritage standpoint, from a tradition standpoint, to provide these challenges. It also gives us an opportunity to look at, you know, we're able to compare Ben Hogan to Jordan Spieth and Scottie Scheffler, and we're able to look and see golf courses in the way they were played back in the golden age versus the way they're played now. I think it would really be a shame if the tour was to lose these great places that are the benchmarks for their golf courses and the places that they've played for a long period of time. So the way we look at it, Colonial has always been and still is a relevant test of golf for these guys. I mean, obviously, certain players like playing here versus others, but I think within the overall scope of testing every aspect of your game, Colonial is about as good as you get out on tour.
Gil, can't wait to see how the golf course plays this week. Hope you get more pats on the back as opposed to daggers. Thanks for the time, and have a great week.
Cheers, guys. Always great being with you. Thank you.
One of those names we're going to be watching out for is 17-year-old Blades Brown.
You might remember the name from the 2023 U.S. Amateur at Cherry Hills Country Club. He became the youngest co-medalist at stroke play in U.S. amateur history. Get this, he broke a record that stood for 103 years and was previously held by none other than Bobby Jones, who was 18 at the time. Blades given a sponsor exemption into the Myrtle Beach Classic in South Carolina, where he showed up and showed out, made the cut, and finished in a tie for 26th. And Blades Brown joins us now from the U.S. Am 4 Ball in Philadelphia. Great to see you. Happy belated birthday, by the way. You turned 17 yesterday. Got a lot of cool things going on in terms of golf, but you only turned 17 once. What was the coolest thing you did for your birthday yesterday?
Oh, man, yesterday all my family came over. We had about the biggest cookie cake I've ever seen. And, yeah, it was awesome. Sprinkled some golf in there, too. So.
Are you feeling a little bit of pressure, not just now that you're getting older, Blades, but you're showing up at the amateur four ball here, but you're coming off a made cut on the PGA Tour when you were just 16 years of age. Do you feel a little bit more attention or expectation this week?
I wouldn't really call it expectation. I like to view pressure as excitement. I'm definitely going to use that as confidence heading into this event. I'm lucky enough to have an awesome teammate, Jackson Harrington. And yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun this week.
What's the most valuable lesson you learned from making the cut at the Myrtle Beach Classic? You had to grind it out. You did. What'd you learn?
I learned that, one, golf is really, really fun and is really, really challenging at that stage. But that golf out there is no different than me just going out and play golf with some of my friends. All the only thing that's different is that it's at an awesome venue and you're playing against the best in the world.
When you are playing against the best in the world, did you assess your game and see where you think you have the most headroom to improve to be closer to those guys?
Absolutely. I mean, I had so much fun playing in the Myrtle Beach Classic. Can't thank Sport 5 and the Myrtle Beach for giving me that opportunity, and I feel like that's where I belong.
Speaking of opportunity, you signed a name, image, and likeness deal with Transcend Capital Advisors and Callaway Golf. In what ways do they support you, but how do you make sure that support doesn't turn into pressure?
Oh, man, that's the best. I mean, every factor, because with golf, there's so many outside factors. With just having their support and having their financial stability, as long as my family just supporting me in every possible way that they can, not only allows me to play free on the golf course, but gives me an awesome team.
What was the coolest part of the week, Blades, where you found yourself just pinching yourself and wondering if this was actually happening?
I was on the putting green, and I've gotten to meet so many amazing people, like Ben Griffin. But the coolest one was seeing or putting on the same putting green as Joel Damon. I look over at Jack, and I'm like, Jack, that's Joel Damon over there. And it was so surreal to be able to play in the same tournament with those guys.
Netflix star and PGA Tour winner Joel Damon. Well, Blades, all the great things happening, I still understand your mom holds you accountable, you have said. In what ways does mom do that?
Oh, man. She's a teacher at my high school, Burnwood Academy. And when I came back, I had 3 days to make up a week and a half of school and study for exams. So luckily I was able to do that, but let's just say I'm nocturnal.
And you got another year to go before you can start to push back on that when you get to 18 years old. How nice was it to share that week in Myrtle Beach with your dad, who's had some health issues over the last few years as well? That had to be a pretty cool experience.
Yeah, it was amazing to be able to, because I mean, when he was diagnosed with leukemia, it hit me hard because I was given the fact that he might not live for very long. And it was so special to be able to play in a PGA Tour event, because that's something that we've been talking about for forever. And for it to become reality is insane.
In what ways do you feel you have more perspective in the important things in life because of what your family has gone through?
Absolutely, yeah. I think my perspective has definitely changed because it's not, I mean, at the end of the day, it's not, yes, it is just whoever can get the ball into the hole with least amount of strokes. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's even bigger than that. And I'm so blessed to have a dad that is as supportive as he is in my family. And just to be able to be in the position that I am is incredible.
What are your ambitions in this game now, Blades? Where do you see yourself? I know you're only 17 now. Where do you see yourself in 5 years, 10 years in this game?
Hopefully on the PGA Tour. I have ambitious goals. I'm hoping some of them can be reached, but to be able to play on the PGA Tour would be incredible.
You've already accomplished that, and you're only 17 at this point.
Incredible. And you got more big days ahead, including golf's longest day on June 3rd. That's 36 holes of golf, Blaze. You're young. I know you can handle it, but how do you prepare for such an important day, trying to make it into the national championship?
Well, to be able to play in the U.S. Open is definitely a goal of mine, and for to be given a shot at it is incredible. I haven't gotten the spot to where I'm going to play yet, but I'm hoping or any venue that the USGA has is going to be awesome, and I'm so excited.
Just at the start of your career and things are looking up. Happy 17th birthday. Best of luck in Philadelphia. Hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you, guys.
We're back on golf today. Lee Y. Bransky is a golf course artist who creates paintings and prints, golf art, more for events, majors, golf courses, and more. He's been commissioned to create drawings and paintings for the finest clubs and organizations in the game. Cream of the crop, folks. Cypress Point, Pine Valley, the Old Course, at St. Andrews as well. And so nice to have Lee Y. Bransky with us. And before we unveil the 2024 U.S. Open artwork, besides you, what is your process of deciding which part of the golf course you choose, whether it's a certain hole or the clubhouse? You've been doing this for so many years.
Yeah, this is my 17th U.S. Open poster, Damon, and the process is always the same. I visit the site 6 months to a year in advance. I always look for 3 or 4 main characters in every poster. One of those characters is always going to be the golf course, obviously, in that this is the national championship. But with my camera and my sketchbook, I try to find 2 or 3 other sort of signature elements to each venue and each year's championship. At Pinehurst, of course, due to the history of Pinehurst and also its new role as an anchor site and a home to the USGA's new headquarters, we decided to really showcase some of the southern charm and hospitality that is unique to Pinehurst in the world of golf.
When you mention the anchor site, Lee, that also suggests that you're going to be seeing a lot of familiar venues in the future. And if you've been doing it for 17 years, you were there doing it 10 years ago when you had both the Open and the Women's Open there. How do you avoid having any kind of repetition in a creative voice when you go back somewhere where you've done the work before?
It is a particular challenge to create a second championship or a third championship poster. But typically, Eamon, you know, as you might expect, these iconic major championship U.S. Open venues, they are resplendent in visual opportunities. There's tremendous opportunities to explore different aspects of the golf course, different features of the campus. So it really hasn't become too much of a challenge yet to find a new interpretation of Pinehurst or a new look at Oakmont, for example. So, you know, Pebble Beach, I've painted probably 5 or 6 times now. And obviously Pebble is really has a wealth of riches, as they say, in terms of visuals. But all the anchor sites afford a lot of opportunity for a visual artist who's willing to look hard.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to seeing what that new look looks like. Can you unveil the 2024 U.S. Open poster for us?
It would be my great pleasure. Here we go.
Oh, look at that.
I have sat in those chairs.
I have as well. A beautiful, beautiful. You see the statue there of the late, great Payne Stewart. Why was this the image that spoke to you, Lee?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, we really wanted to celebrate the southern charm and hospitality of Pinehurst. And I always want my posters to place the viewer in the scene. But here, the scene is just so inviting. You really, as you said, Eamon, if you spent any time at Pinehurst, you sat in one of these rockers already. So we really thought that this view did a few things. First of all, the foreground really showcases, you know, all the relaxed, laid-back qualities of the porch at Pinehurst's iconic clubhouse. We even have one of the small details, a little bit of sweet tea over here to place in North Carolina. And then this view also afforded a nice look at the Payne Stewart statue, of course. I started working in golf in the mid to late 90s. I remember vividly watching on my television when he sank the 15-foot putt to win in 99. So I feel like not only is this sort of a celebration of a magical moment in golf, but it's really a direct homage to the U.S. Open itself, in that the 1999 championship was, you know, certainly one of the top 2 or 3 U.S. Opens in my lifetime, I think. So That's how we collaborated with the USGA to select this view.
Are there any hidden details in here, Lee, that someone who owns this and has it on the wall might spot as time goes by that may not be immediately visible?
There is one, funny that you ask, Damon, there's one small Easter egg in here, so to speak. Some of you may know that this is, in fact, or will be, the 1,000th championship conducted by the USGA. So if you're looking closely at the poster, once you get a copy for yourself, you may find a little nod to that somewhere in there.
Well, that's very, very cool. Speaking of finding those at home that want to find and purchase the U.S. Open artwork, how would they go about doing that?
Well, first and foremost, I'm thrilled to say I'll be on site at Pinehurst in June. 6th to the 9th is pre-championship, when anyone who wants to can just come on in and have a look around and shop in the merchandise tent. That's the pre-champ. I'll be there 4 days of that. And then the 10th to the 16th, of course, championship week, I'll be setting up camp again in the merchandise tent for a thrilling week of golf during the championship. The poster is also available at usgashop.com online. And then any of my past 16 posters for the U.S. Open can be found at our website, leewybransky.com.
Fantastic. All roads lead to Pinehurst number 2. Can't wait to see you there next month, Lee. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, fellas. Look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome back on Golf Today. Last week in Kentucky, PGA of America professional Brady Shattuck earned low PGA Pro honors at Valhalla. Represented quite a comeback for Shattuck, who was forced to put his PGA Tour dreams behind him in 2019 following a car accident that led to two herniated discs, a concussion, and nerve damage in his legs. And after wrapping at Valhalla, Shattuck drove straight to the Delaware Valley Open. And what did he do? Broke the course record with 63 and won the tournament. That's what they call an encore. And Braden Shattuck joins us now. Braden, congratulations on the hot run that you're on right now. When you made the cut and it was clear you were going to be low club professional at Valhalla, did at any point it cross your mind not to drive 10 hours and play this sectional event the next day?
Totally. I mean, once I found out I was going to be low club pro and I knew I was going to have to wait around for 6 or 7 hours, do some interviews afterwards, I was like, sheesh, I might have to reconsider doing this whole 10, 11 hour drive thing on no sleep. So I was totally in between on the fence what I wanted to do, but we ended up doing it anyways.
You play, you teach. I mean, you don't have the hours that a PGA Tour player does to put the time into their game. How did you peak to have such a great week at Valhalla and then follow it up with another win?
Luckily, I was fortunate enough last year with the win in the PGA Professional Championship that I got 6 tour starts. So I actually have been spending the last few weeks before the PGA Championship on the road playing the PGA Tour. So I've been able to dial in my game for the last month, which helps a lot playing at the highest level.
So when you're playing PGA Tour events and you're coming off the low pro honors at Valhalla, Braden, did you feel a pressure in the sectional event that you didn't feel the last time you played that event? Are the expectations a little bit higher now, and are you conscious of that?
I think the expectations are probably higher for me, but I think that the PGA Tour courses and tournaments are so hard, they demand such good golf from you and they command it, that it makes you elevate your game. And I think that it kind of happened without me really realizing it. So I think going back home to play in tournaments, even if there is maybe more pressure on me, I'm able to handle it because my game has improved.
Braden, you had to put your life back together again in 2019 following the car accident and go through rehab and deal with the concussion, the herniated discs that you had, the nerve damage, and now you've climbed a mountain to win the Delaware Valley event and to be the low pro at the PGA Championship. Have you thought about your future a little bit and maybe rethinking what's possible for you now?
Yeah, I think it's easy to jump to conclusions and but in reality, I know all I want to do is continue to improve my golf game for as long as I can. That's been my passion. And I'm going to continue doing what I do. And if that takes me to the PGA Tour, great. If not, I will be perfectly happy helping out my members at Rolling Green and helping out everybody I can, teaching and playing in as many local and statewide tournaments as I can.
What was the recovery like for you after that car accident, Braden? Not just in the physical and emotional sense, but did you have to change your golf swing to compensate for injuries that you'd sustained?
Yes. Yeah, I had to change up my golf swing, the way I set up to it, the equipment that I have. It was kind of a little bit of an overhaul, per se, to make it work for my back. And there were things that I couldn't really do. Initially, I couldn't really side bend. I couldn't rotate a ton. So I had to build my swing around all of that. And hinging from the waist, trying to rotate really hard is not good for your back. So that was what I worked around and rebuilt my swing around with new equipment.
And you built it to the point where you're standing next to Xander Schauffele on a Sunday in the gloaming in Louisville, Kentucky. What was the coolest part of the entire week at Valhalla?
I mean, having my friends there, my best friends there to share that with was pretty amazing. And, you know, it was really fun because I putted really well and made a lot of really big putts. I got a lot of big roars and actually finished number one in the field for the week in putting. So having my friends there to, like, experience that with was incredible.
Braden, it's great to see you playing great golf and healthy as well. Congratulations on all the great accomplishments. Stay in touch. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.